Okay, here we go for this evening's. It's already on. It's on already. Okay. So here we go. Question number one. Ajahn, when I meditate, flashes of lights appear. Then my mind automatically focuses my attention to those lights. Then those lights fade away. Ah. I have tried focusing on the breath, even after my attention goes to those lights. Still they fade away. What should I do when I see those lights? Nothing. That's always the case. Now, it's almost like in every stage of the meditation, you know, you're sort of doing present moment awareness or silence or watching the breath. You need a greater degree of non-interference to be able to allow those states to develop. So when you get to the nimitta, the lights, you really have to be very good at being able to watch something without the slightest of interference. Because if you get involved even tiny amount, then those lights will fade away. The simile, and this has come up a couple of times in the interviews, and I promised I would bring this up sometime, and now must be the time to answer this question, is a simile of Ajahn Chah and the still forest pool, where he would always camp in the evening when he was going wandering through the jungles, about 10 or 20 meters from the edge of a lake or river, because he would use that water to bathe, to drink, and maybe wash some robes. And then, when it got about this time of night, dusk, he would sit there, sometimes meditate, but sometimes with his eyes open. Because at that time, the animals would come out from the jungle, because they also wanted to drink and wash. But they'd only come out if he was sitting absolutely still. Because remember, this was a jungle. And the animals, the only time they'd see human beings would be when those human beings were hunters. So they were scared of those human beings. So if they thought there was a human being around, they didn't know the difference between an Ajahn Chah and a hunter. So they would run away back into the forest if they thought somebody was there. But Ajahn Chah used to say that often he could sit so still with his eyes open, so the animals didn't know he was there. So they would come out and play by the still forest pool. And he would enjoy watching them just play and drink and mess around like you see in Nature Channel. But sometimes he was so still that some animals would come out. Rare animals. Animals he never believed existed. Beautiful. But they would only come out when he was really still. Because they were so sensitive. If they thought that somebody was watching, they'd run away again and wouldn't come out again for weeks. And of course, you should know, understand the simile. When you go and sit by the still forest pool of your mind, the animals will come out to play, nimittas, jhanas, but only if you're so still that's as if they don't know you're watching. So your job when these lights come up, the only reason they disappear or they fade away is because you're watching too hard. You've got to be just like an Ajahn Chah, so still the nimitta doesn't realize you are watching. Or, like one of our other disciples who's married to a Thai lady who works for the Sunday Times, he told me that once there was a rumor going around Perth that Kylie Minogue had had a breakdown and that she was hiding out with her mother at Cable Beach Resort. And so there's only a rumor. And he was sent by the newspaper just to go up there, just in case. And he said that he actually crawled through the bushes. And he saw her. And so he was, for one day, he was a paparazzi. He got his one moment of fame. He managed to shoot Kylie Minogue in Cable Beach Resort. It's a pretty mean thing to do, but that was his job. And anyhow, his picture got syndicated all around the world. That was his one moment of fame. But he had to do that. He had to be like Ajahn Chah. Because if Kylie Minogue knew there was a paparazzi crawling through the bush, So she would have hidden and he would never come out again for weeks, just like Nimittas. That's why they call, you know, Kylie Minogue a star, like a Nimitta. You want to get out now, please. Well, this is what happens. This is how you've got to be that quiet to get these experiences coming along. So the only reason those Nimitta fades away is because you haven't learned yet how to be that extra degree of stillness. And this is actually the training. So those Nimittas will actually train you to be able to watch something without interfering at all. To be able to see something without the slightest bit of control. And then that Nimitta will stay there. It'll stay a long time. And then you get the next test of trying to get into a jhana or not. Where again, you have to be really still. So every stage of meditation, it's like you're giving a test. And eventually you learn how to pass that test. It doesn't matter how many times you fail. Eventually you learn how to pass the test and to be able to hold a Nimitta. And it doesn't move, it doesn't go anywhere. So that's how it all works. So once you learn about Nimittas and jhanas, oh, you can get a job as a paparazzi. No trouble at all. Any comments about that question? Okay. Yeah, you have, yeah? That's one way of doing it. Stay with the breath until the Nimitta stabilizes. But really the very, very best way is just let the mind decide what it wants to do. So you just don't give any orders. If the mind really wants to go to the Nimitta, it will just go there by itself. If it wants to stay with the breath, it will stay there by itself. So you just be passenger. What is your attitude to the body? Do you see it as simply a vehicle to the jhanas and nirvana, and for that reason only to be treated well, or are the body and mind inseparable? Oh, I'd be terrible if the body and mind were inseparable, because it means when my body gets old, my mind will get old as well. So it's, when my body aches, my mind will ache. So no, the body is something completely different than the mind. So it is, I like to look at the body as a vehicle. You've got to care for your car, you know, wash it, service it, make sure it's, you know, well fed with gas or vitamin T, as I call it. That's cups of tea. In order to be sort of nice and fit and healthy. So you look after your body, but you don't sort of worry about it too much. Because no matter how well you look after it, no matter how much yoga, or how much muesli, or how much yogurt, you still get heart attacks. So nevertheless, you try and do your very best, but it's a pretty hopeless task. But what you can do, you can really train the mind. So the body is the vehicle, and the mind is what will take you into the jhanas. There's a simile which I got from the Samanyapala Sutra, where King Ajatasattu went to visit the Buddha in the bamboo grove. So he went in his royal chariot, as far as a chariot could go. And then he got out from his chariot and walked with his shoes, as far as he could walk with his shoes. And when he got to the hall in the bamboo grove, he took off his shoes and entered the place where the Buddha was. So in each case he had different vehicles to be used at different times of the journey. First the chariot, then the shoes, and then he had to go barefoot. The same way that we have the different vehicles which we use to get into deep meditation, to go into the deep meditations, as it were, where the Buddha mind is. So first of all, we can use, say, the breath. That's like the chariot. And then we use like the nimittas. So we get out of the chariot, out of the breath, which is very, very fine, beautiful light. And then before we get into jhana, we leave the nimitta outside as we get into the jhanas. Like we take off our shoes to go into the hall where the Buddha sits. So all these vehicles have a different use at different times. When we go back to our everyday lives to keep our mind strong, we keep TV watching and reading books to a minimum. Yeah, it's a good idea. Because, you know, the TV just fills your mind up with what we call junk food for the mind. Just like this junk food for the body, which tastes nice, but it's not all that healthy. So there's junk food for the mind. And junk food for the mind is called TV. If you can read some books, but read some good books. You know, so open the door of your heart, for example. So read some good books instead of reading rubbish books. To maintain ongoing awareness, do we choose one sensory modality and ignore others? There is too much happening, even with one. Okay, just first of all, you've just got to arouse awareness and understand that a lot of awareness gets strengthened when you sort of relax and do very little, so all the energy goes into knowing. And then later on, once you've got that degree of awareness, you can start focusing it, like you focus the energy of the sun by using a magnifying glass on one thing. But sometimes focusing on one thing is a little bit too much of doing, so a lot of time you just allow this to happen. And probably tomorrow morning I'll give you some tips on how focusing happens. You don't focus as an act of will, but focusing happens as an act of letting go, the opposite of will. So you don't focus and concentrate, you know, and screw up your face and screw up your mind. You find that you just gently take one thing and you go into it. And you sort of dive into it and keep diving into it. And as you get closer and closer to the center, the things on the outside vanish. But I'm going to talk about that tomorrow and focusing. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I know why you like this place. It's proof positive that good walls can be built out of bad bricks. That's very perceptive. Because sometimes people say that about my simile, about in your wall there are two bad bricks, but there's 998 good bricks. And people say, in my wall, we've got 998 bad bricks and only two good bricks. Say, no, there's always good bricks around. And even the bad bricks are good. They're perfect. When I come out of a nimitta, everything I see is surrounded by a strong, bright light for a while, and I feel very peaceful and blissed out. After that, I'm exhausted and need a nap. I thought you said these states empower you. Ah, now, this is an interesting one. That may be that if you force a nimitta with a bit of willpower, then maybe that does tire you. But if it's like a natural nimitta, which comes really from letting go, you get energized. So I'm not sure, but whoever wrote this can actually talk to me about this in the interview. But that sounds to me, my first diagnosis, will be you're forcing that limiter, which means that's why you lose energy at the very end of it. You still get some bliss, you still can get a limiter, but a little bit too much willpower is involved in there, which is why that, you know, you need a nap afterwards. Because usually when people get limiters, or especially in the deep meditations, wow, you know, you've just got so much energy. And it happens here that people can't sleep, and they say, I can't sleep, what's going on? And that's, and I tell people, that's just natural, just carry on, enjoy yourself, and you get to sleep later on when you go home. Can we please have the lights on during the evening chanting, as I don't know the Pali words yet, I need to read them, I don't think I'm alone here, thank you. Did you put the lights on today? Yeah, the lights are on, enough lights are on. But it doesn't matter, sometimes people don't want the lights on so they can carry on sleeping and no one notices them. So anyway, so I think there's probably enough lights on, so you can carry on the chanting. And as Ajahn Chah used to say, if you don't know the word, you can always hum the tune. So he was, even when I went to Japan, he had these big ceremonies, and one of the Theravada monks, he was the, I've already started this now, he was the head of the Mahamakut Buddhist University. And so he's like, he's a great scholar. And they asked him to do a chant, and all he did was the itipiso, like we do every evening here. And he got to the end of it, and he fluffed it. He forgot what comes next. And he's this great monk. Of course, you know, only a few of us noticed what was going on. So even the great monks, you can make mistakes in the chanting. So you just do it your best and see what happens. Remember when Ajahn Chah did that, the first katina we do, there's a special chant we do at every katina, Kali Vedanti Sapanya. And we learned it and practiced it and practiced it and practiced it. We all had it perfect. When Ajahn Chah came for the ceremony, he started the chant. In the middle of the chant, he sort of flipped over to a completely different chant. He got it completely wrong. But he carried on chanting. We all stopped. We didn't know what's going on next. And all the lay people thought, these Western monks, they don't know anything. Ajahn Chah for the chant right. So that's why I don't really worry about chanting. Get it right, you get it wrong. Anyway, if the body can contort into weird positions during deep meditation, it's okay to let it do so. How come you don't see the monks, nuns sitting in front at this or other retreats doing that. Because we meditated so much, we're already healthy. All our contortions have been taken out of us. Is there some element of control where you can choose not to go into the funny positions? Should we also try to keep things under wraps when meditating in public? No, because don't worry what other people think of you. You know, even if you're a monk, you can just, because it's, otherwise it's just too much sort of stress and strain trying to prove yourself to other people. And if you're a monk for a long time, you just can't live like that, just trying to act a role. So that's why, you know, you get all my bad jokes, so that's how I am, and I'm not going to change just to make you happy. So that's who I am, and that's it. So it's the same when you sit, you know, you sit as comfortably as you can, and just things happen just by yourself. So you don't really worry about what other people think of you. Last night you mentioned that the thought that came into our head were actually invited by us. How do we stop inviting them in? Aha, by being happy in silence. By being content, just in this beautiful, quiet mind. You know what it's like sometimes? I remember this when I was a student. Sometimes you get bored and you go looking in the refrigerator for something to eat. And it's packed, but there's nothing to eat. You turn on the TV and there's nothing on the TV. There's heaps of stuff on the TV, but nothing interests you. Pick up a book. You've already read that. And that's that boredom. You know, you always want something else, want something more. Whatever you have, you never find contentment with it. And that's like the bored mind. And sometimes when you meditate, you get bored. Because the meditation is not really sort of biting. You're not really interested in the silence or in the present moment. So you just go looking for things to think about. You really go searching, you know, in your sort of data bank of fantasies, memories, plans, something to sort of disturb yourself. It's amazing that a lot of times there's nothing to do, so just don't do anything. But that's why we have like this entertainment of TVs and something for bored people. It's amazing just the rubbish they see on TV. Apparently there's something called reality TV. And that people keep saying just how terrible that is and how gross that is and how dumb that is. But it's got the highest ratings of any other show. But how dumb it is, people like watching it. And why do they do that? Because it's interesting, apparently. I've never seen any reality TV. But apparently that people love looking at it. So why? It's just because people are bored out of their skulls. They don't know what to do with themselves because they haven't learned how just to be at ease with peaceful things. And after a while, in this retreat, after a while, you know, you tend to get at ease with the silence. And it's comfortable. And because you value the silence really a lot, then thoughts can't come in. The silence is more important. So important, the silence doesn't have it. The thoughts don't have a chance. And you don't go around looking for someone to distract yourself. It's just because the mind isn't content. That's why we think. And the more the mind is content, the more we don't need to go and look for things to disturb ourselves. Dear Ajahn, is this mind you talk about the same mind for all of us? No way. I'm not going to take control. I'm not going to take responsibility for your mind. So your mind is your mind. My mind is my mind. So it's not the same, but it's the same model, you know, it's the same idea. So once you know one mind, you know all the minds. You know how they work. They're the same, like, the same sort of model, same sort of make. So once you can fix one up, you can fix them all up. So it's very, very similar how the mind works. So once I know my mind, that's why I can become a teacher. I can actually help other people, because, you know, I've spent all my time not reading your minds, but reading my minds. And so when I read mine and I can understand how my mind works, I can understand how yours works. And that's what the Buddha did. He understood totally the way his mind works, so he could really understand just how everyone else's mind works. Doesn't matter male, female, even animals, any gender, any race. And that's where you get the wisdom from. So if you know how your mind works, you can know all minds. But they're all different, thank goodness. Does that make any sense? Is that really the question they were asking? Okay. My mind is more still during walking meditation if I wear shoes because my ankles are slightly wobbly in bare feet. Are shoes okay, or should I persevere with bare feet? Your shoes are okay, as long as you don't wear high heels doing walking meditation. Well, you don't know, so it might be a fashion statement. So please don't wear killer heels on a walking meditation path. Yeah, sure, you can wear shoes, it's no problem at all. If one should not go out and disturb the sounds and be at peace with the sounds, how come then, some years past, all the monks, including the abbot, were going to leave Bodhi's monastery if the noise of the clay trucks was not stopped, as the noise from the trucks was disturbing the monks' meditation? Actually, the main reason why we were fighting those clay trucks was because of the danger of the road. Because it was one Friday afternoon, one of those clay trucks going down the road lost complete control, so he was going so fast there's no way he could brake, and the only thing he did was actually to drive into the side, the bank, to literally turn the truck over. It's actually a truck with a trailer on the back, and use the friction of the whole two trailers sliding across the road to slow himself down and stop. It was a courageous thing to do, but just so dangerous. And when I saw that, remember KC, he went down and interviewed the guy afterwards. And once I saw that, I realized that it's my responsibility to make sure that road is safe for all the people who come up to bring dana, as well as all the monks and other people who live there. So it was a safety issue was the main reason why I thought that. Because you have a responsibility as a monk to look after people's safety. Any questions about that? Next question. Dear Ajahn Brahm, today while I was meditating, I felt an insect crawling on my arm. It's probably a redback. Deadly, dangerous. It is. Even in Thailand, you know, they had so many insects, and they would always crawl over. You used to have the tarantulas. I'm not joking, real tarantulas, big ones. And they would actually just be on the rafters. And because it was really hot, you'd either meditate, if you rested, you rested just with your top, you know, off, the bare chested. And every now and again, a tarantula would fall on you. And they're really tickly. They never bit you, they never hurt at all. You get used to that after a while, tarantulas walking all over you. So these are only tiny spiders over here. What's the problem? Come on, don't be a wuss. I felt an insect crawling on my arm. I wasn't sure whether to ignore it and continue to meditate or brush it off. I did brush it off, and it disturbed my meditation. Is it true what they say that when you radiate enough metta, that nothing, no insect, animal will harm you? Should I ignore any such sensation and continue with my meditation in the future? Thank you with much metta. Okay, it really depends. If that little insect is really irritating you because, you know, you can't stand the little itchiness, then maybe you can just very carefully just pick it up and put it down without injuring it, or just blow it off. And it's really disturbing you. And if you do it very, very gently and calmly, you know, with compassion, it doesn't disturb the meditation. It's just like, I call it pressing the pause button of your meditation. So you pause and go back a little bit, but you don't really lose too much, and you can carry on meditating. But if it's just a tiny insect, just leave it alone. It'll just crawl around, have some fun, explore things, and then just go home again. Because there's nothing there for it. You're not its food. Not even sort of little ants with a big enough appetite they can sort of think they can swallow you. So just, you know, leave it alone. It'll go up and it'll go down again. And that way it won't bother you. I remember saying something like that. You know, it's the fly season already. I remember sort of people asking me that at the Saturday afternoon meditation in Nolamara. And of course, as soon as I said that, I'll just leave it alone, don't worry about it. When I started the meditation, of course, a fly landed right on my nose. Who knows? And I thought, I better not sort of blow it away, because I just told other people just to leave it alone. So it's true, I just watched it. And it was amazing. It did like, it's amazing, it must have been a Buddhist, right? It did three circuits of my mouth. Round and around. And around. When it went the third time round, it sort of went away. It's what we call like paying respect. Circumambulation. very, very fascinating, because what you actually found is that these parts, the edges, are far more sensitive than the middle. So, you know, I was waiting. When it got down here, it was really tickly. But as soon as it passed the corners, then it was okay again. But I had to wait to get to the corners again. It was really tickly down there. Otherwise, it was okay. Underneath here was no problem at all. But on the edges, that's really tickly when you've got a fly in your mouth. But then it just flew away again afterwards. So, you know, I really understood about sort of the nature of my sensations on my mouth. The edges are the tickly ones. Middle's no problem at all. So you can brush it off, you can blow it off or whatever. So, just, it's not going to harm you. So you can just have fun with it and enjoy it. No big deal. Ajahn Brahm, what is the best way to cultivate contentedness? To realize it is as good as it's going to get. And you're not going to get any more than this, so you might as well sort of enjoy it while it's here. So be contented. And contentedness is actually goes against the grain of our modern world, which always says get more, buy more, achieve more, go different places. And because of that, you're so conditioned in wanting something else by the media, by advertising. These days, it's so hard to be content. And even if you are content, it's almost as if you're bad for the economy. So contentedness is a very, very difficult thing. It really is going against the grain. And sometimes, if we're really content, we'll do nothing in the world. There'll be no sort of, no development. That wouldn't be good. We've developed enough already. So the more contented you are, the more you realize just the beauty of contentedness. And really, I mean, what are we working so hard for anyway? Sometimes you go to work, or as a monk, I go to work and just go teaching, and sometimes, what are you doing that for? What are you working for? You're working so that you can be peaceful, so you can retire and be content. Maybe that might be just the weekends. So you finish the work, and now you can sit down and relax and be content. Unfortunately, the contentedness or contentment just is so elusive. As soon as we finish one thing, we want something else. Sometimes I notice that people, they say, oh, if only I could come to Australia, if only I could get my visa, if only I can pay off my mortgage, then I'll be happy, and then I'll be content. It would be wonderful if you think that way. But what happens usually, as soon as we finish one thing, we start another thing. So contentment never comes to us. We never rest. So contentment is say, right now I've got enough. My meditation is good enough. I've had enough to eat, enough to sleep. This is good enough, and then you can be content. Just for a few minutes, where there's nothing you want. I'm not sure about you, but I remember even as a kid, I remember a few moments when I was totally content. A few moments in my life as a child, where there was nothing I wanted, no place I'd rather be. And I had everything I needed for that day. And that was a wonderful experience of total contentment, no wanting at all. As a child, I remember those. Now as a monk, you can do that very, very often. Just sit down, and there's nothing you want in the whole world. Yeah. Yeah, very good. So when you don't want anything, that's called contentment. You have enough. So how much do you really want? How much do you need to be really content? Don't think if I get jhana then I'll be content, because you know the second jhana to get afterwards. Not the second jhana, this is the fourth jhana. So it's endless. So for you, just learn to be content. And that's actually what contentment is. No craving. Just completely happy with what you've got. And it doesn't have to be perfect before you're content. Which is why I tell people at Nala Mala, when you go home in the evening and you look at all the dirty dishes in the sink, before you go washing them, count how many dishes are already clean up in the shelves. And if there's more clean dishes than dirty dishes, quit while you're ahead. So be content. There's enough dishes for tomorrow. Why is it that's a hard thing to do? Because you always want to get things out of the way, first of all, and then I can be content. And that's the problem with people, we just do too much. Oh, just remember about the monkey simile last night. You know, just I'll collect the bananas first of all. I'll peel them first of all. I'll put them in my mouth, get that out of the way, then I'll meditate. Because that's the discontent. When there's always something needed, something to be done, something wrong. The contentment is just being grateful for this moment. This is good enough. It's perfect enough. I'm perfect enough. You're perfect enough. You're good enough. And that gives you this beautiful contentment. And when you develop that contentment, you get the insight. Actually, you were perfect enough. It was good enough. What was the similarity essence of the Dharma teachings and Vinaya training rules of all the previous Buddhas? Now that's an interesting question, because I only know one Buddha. So, all the previous Buddhas which both existed, nothing much was said about them. So who knows what was the similarity essence? I suppose they all knew how to be content. They all knew. I don't know why you laughed at that. But fair enough, I'm content with you laughing at that. So I don't really know what the answer to that one, but sometimes I wonder, why do you want to know that answer? Because just one Buddha is enough to teach us how to be enlightened. And certainly the essence of the teachings of the Buddha, you can actually see, are the essence of the teachings which you find when you meditate. As I've taught for the last year or so, because I was about a year or 15 months ago, some school kids asked a question, the Muslims have the Quran, the Christians have the Bible, what's the Buddhist holy book? I think the teacher told them to ask these questions. And instead of saying the Tipitaka, I said the Buddhist holy book is meditation. Because that's where you get all your answers for, that's what you read. That's really the holy book of Buddhism, your meditation. And teaching like that is a wonderful little answer there, because that opens up other avenues to say what's the similarity teachings of all Buddhas. It's what you can find out in your own heart. The peace, the stillness, the happiness, the freedom, which they write about in the books, which you really read in your own heart. So that's the holy book of Buddhism. So you're great students. This few days, you've been reading the holy book of Buddhism deep inside you. Is that okay? Okay, next question. Would it be true to say the majority of us lay people will never be free? 100%. True to say that the majority of us lay people will never be free 100% of thinking and meditation because of our involvement with the worldly five senses. So really, isn't a waste of time, you being here. Should you all pack up your bags and go home this evening? If the answer to that question was yes, you know, you should pack up. But it is not true, because, you know, people have meditation, they've been free of thinking, they've got into jhanas on these retreats. So it has happened. So if they can do it, why can't you? So that's a nice challenge for you. Other people have done it. And they're no different than you. They've got two ears, a mouth, and a nose in between. So what's the difference between them and you? So if they've done it, why can't you do it? So yeah. So you can be free of thinking. But then you have to go back to thinking again afterwards when you go back to the world. But at least you know what it's like to be free. So it becomes a real holiday for you. Do people who naturally have a joyful and cheerful disposition have an easier time practicing Dharma and meditation? Yeah, of course they do. Because if you have a jolly and cheerful disposition, you're somebody who can actually see the beauty in things. So you can see the beauty in this moment. You can see the beauty in the breath. You can see the beauty in the little ant crawling up your arm. So when you see the beauty in things, it gives you contentment. And the contentment brings you stillness, and stillness brings you the deep meditations. And then you really get happy then. So it is great to develop a jolly, happy disposition. Which is why if you're miserable in the morning, if you're someone who is always going around frowning, remember that wonderful exercise in Opening the Door of Your Heart, that amazing book, $24.99 special offer. Get your two fingers out and push up. So you practice how to smile. Now, seriously, it's a good thing to do that during your meditation, even. Because if you're having a hard time meditating, it's not biting, and you know, you're struggling. Keep your eyes closed and put your attention on your mouth and make the mouth smile. And fake the smile. Because when you smile, straight away that gives a sense of joy to the mind. There's a connection there. But all you need is that little bit of joy to the mind, and it's very much easier to meditate. When I was a student at Cambridge, I also sort of started doing some rowing in these boats. It was just for fun, because I was never a competitive person, so I never went to the Oxford-Cambridge boat race or anything like that. It was just for fun. But I remember once going on a race, and it's really hard work. You had to be very fit to row in those eights. And I was rowing, I was getting really tired and worn out. And, you know, they have a coach who's on a bicycle with a megaphone who shouts at you as you're racing. And he shouted at me and he said, "You're making a terrible face, an ugly face. Smile, for goodness sake." And that was his simple advice. And I followed it. And it was amazing. That was the first time when I was really struggling to pull that oar and keep up with everybody. When I smiled, it became far easier to pull that oar. And just the expression on my face made it more difficult. And that became sort of a great insight, which I use in meditation as well. If I'm getting dull, or things aren't happening in meditation, sometimes I remember just to close my eyes and smile. And then straight away, so the mind picks up, and you can get into a nice meditation from there. So you can develop happiness, faking that happiness, even in your meditation. And if you actually do that all the time, you're a jolly happy person, then you get a boost in your meditation. So that's a very good thing to be. So if you are a jolly, cheerful disposition, you do have an easier time. If you're not jolly yet, then I can tell you a few jokes, which will either make you run away, or will actually make you jolly. Thank you for the wonderful Dhamma talk this morning. Ah, I like that question. That's the best question today. See, I made you laugh. What is the best way to practice mindfulness while walking from here to there or walking for exercise? Okay, just keep it simple. Because if you make it complicated, it's very hard to create mindfulness. Because it just uses up all your energy. Keep it simple and just be in the moment. So don't get to the toilet until your body gets there. So you be on the journey. Wherever you are, that's where you have to be. So don't go ahead of yourself, even when you're walking. So don't think of, you know, the room you're going to go to and the nice, lovely bed and the soft pillow which is waiting for you out there until you actually get there. Okay then. This is a nice start to the question. Okay then. The Lord Buddha recommended full ordination of Sangha, as full ordination is the fast way, the safe way. So then the nuns of Dhammasara should take up the full ordination to bhikkhunis as soon as possible. Okay? You want to ordain this evening? Look, you know that I'm one of the ones who want to have that full ordination, but you just can't do things just because you want them. Just like you want to be... How many people want to get jhanas? Yeah? Okay, but you know, you can't just, okay, let's do it this evening. It takes a lot of preparation and work. Same with the ordination. As Ajahn Wayama said, he keeps on saying to me, look, we want to be trained so we know what it's like to be a bhikkhuni. So we know all of the things we're supposed to do. We don't want to just become a bhikkhuni just for the name of it, for the status. Because there's lots of responsibilities. The next responsibility is Sister Satima knows. She's a bhikkhuni. But we want to be able to train everybody so they're very, very good bhikkhunis. And that's what Sister Wayama wants. And I agree with that. So we want to sort of try and make it happen. But we don't rush these things, you know, just to be PC. We've got to make sure it happens well. So yeah, it's going to happen. Any comments or questions about that one? Okay. Is jhana very necessary to reach Magapala? Yet? But it is. I know that sometimes in some parts of the suttas they say, you know, that it looks like they say you can get, say, stream winning without getting jhanas. But I've got on record, I can't see how that can happen. And I'm just going from personal experience, I can't see just how without a jhana you can really see non-self. I'll mention that later on when we do some sort of talks about insight. This is like a personal thing. So I really think that you do need jhanas. And anyway, it's certainly much, 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 much easier if you get the powerful mind of a jhana. And the reason why the jhanas are important, it's not just the power of the mind, it's the data, the experience of what happens within the jhana. And that sort of just blows you away because you see things there which you can't see in any other experience of mental consciousness. And the evidence which you see in those jhanas is just so in your face, so obvious, that many people, they look at those jhana experiences and they understand what they mean and they see things like non-self. Because now one thing, I'm going to go and talk about this now anyway, one thing you see in the jhanas, your will disappears. And you've never seen that before. And you can't even contemplate existing without a will. But in the jhanas, there you are, it's a weird experience. You're in there, you're blissed out, having a wonderful time, perfectly still, and you can't do anything. You can't choose. You can't choose to come out, you can't choose to stay. Just the ability, the option of doing anything is taken away from you. So you're in an experience where the will, the ability to choose, has always been there for you. Even if you don't exercise it, you always can will if you want to. And now it's no longer there. If you contemplate that afterwards, it's obvious that the will has nothing to do with you. It's not part of yourself. Because there you've been, conscious, and no will at all. So number one, you understand what will is. And number two, you realize it's non-self. And that by itself is pretty shocking. All your choosing, all your doing, you think it's coming from you, but it ain't. It's purely 100% conditioned. So all of the things you think you're choosing, you're a good meditator or a bad meditator, you're lazy or you're energetic, all this thing about your will, it's nothing to do with you at all. That makes you very free. If you know the will has nothing to do with me, I can just let it go much more easily. So once you see that, it's very easy to let go and get into jhanas. The will is not you. The Buddha said that very clearly, because the will is a major part of sankhara, the fourth kanda. And the Buddha said heaps and hundreds of times. Now the sankhara is anatta, not me, not mine, not self. Ne tang mama, ne so hamasami, ne tang mama, ne so hamasami, ne me ata, or something like that. I think I'm getting late at night. I'm trying my best. So it says, it's not me, not a mind, not a self. So the Buddha kept on saying that, but people still think that you are the one who chose to come here. That you are the one who decides to write this question. That it came from you. That's what it appears like, and that's what you've been assuming for all your life. And the Buddha comes along and says, nope, it wasn't you who decided to look at me like that. You didn't have any choice, Nisara. Neither do you have any choice. Now when you understand that, it gets really weird, and it gets very scary to realize you really aren't in control. Are completely conditioned from outside, and for the next 9 days you're completely conditioned by me. I'm brainwashing you like hell. But you know it's a good, because it's all good fun. Yeah, choice exists. You can see choice happening, but you want to say, where did it come from? Where did that particular choice or that decision come from? You can actually trace it back. And somehow you can trace it back by all those influences, your parents, your teachers, what you read, what you saw on the TV. That actually is what you choose. Because I don't know about you, but I thought I was a rebel when I was young. And I wanted to, because young people, especially the 60s, were always rebelling against conventions. So I had long hair, and I thought I was really rebellious when I bought my first pair of green velvet trousers, bright green. My mother hated those. But then I remember going to one of these rock concerts, and I saw another 10,000 people all with green velvet trousers. How is this just another uniform? Only a different uniform. It's so hard to rebel. So then you sort of shave off your hair, become a monk, and go to Thailand. Thousands of other people just like you. This really. And then you come to Australia, and then all these lay people start shaving their hair, like John. You just, you can't rebel. Sometimes I think, as a monk, I should grow my hair long to rebel. And why do people want to rebel anyway? Because they really want to be an individual. They want to show that they have an individuality of free choice. But really, all the rebels, they form another sort of group. There's not free choice at all. So it's great actually finding out where you get your choices from. And I gave a talk about that a long time ago. It's one of my favourite talks over at our monastery. I think it was Ajahn Sujato, sort of, he was working in the library then, so he gave it the talk, Why Ajahn Brahm Tells Stupid Jokes. Because I said the reason why, because my father told stupid jokes. And that's actually where I got that from. So he conditioned me. 16 years I lived with that guy. And so he conditioned me so strongly in telling stupid jokes that I tell stupid jokes. And that's just the way it is. Okay, what's a stupid joke? One of the stupid jokes which my father said was, what fun does a monk have? And he'd say, none. And he would laugh. Okay, it takes a while for you to get it. It's late at night. And that came straight from my dad. Stupid jokes like that. What was one of the other ones he used to say? He used to go around saying about one of his relations who had a motorbike accident. And it was a very bad accident, and they took him to hospital. And unfortunately, they had to amputate a leg. But it happens. Even these days, apparently now, before they do an amputation, they actually put an X on the leg. It's true these days. It's just to make sure that they take the right leg off. But this was before they used to do that, and actually they amputated the wrong leg. And so, as soon as they found out, they had to put him back into surgery and amputate the damaged leg. So, he had both legs taken off. And of course, as soon as he could recover, he hired a lawyer to sue the hospital. But he lost his case. He didn't have a leg to stand on. That's another of my father's sick jokes. So now you know why I tell bad jokes. I take absolutely no responsibility for it. It's just anatta, non-self. It just comes from my father. He cut out the conditions. So it's nice, and some of the other things I say, if it's a wise thing, I say, where did that one come from? And I can usually trace it back to Ajahn Chah. But if Ajahn Chah didn't say, I can trace it back to his teachers and his teachers, and that's where it all comes from. So you can trace these things back, all your decisions. Why do I meditate? What do I do that for? And you can actually trace it back. I've got no choice. I have to meditate. So that's wonderful, actually, to see that a choice is, but it doesn't come from you. It makes things so light, so you don't have to feel upset at yourself or guilty if you made some mistake. It's not your fault. Or if you did something really wonderful, you don't feel proud. It's not my fault either. It's just choice, just rolling around, doing its thing. You can let go much more that way. Yeah.
Correct,
yeah. Because there's so many choices. I'd like to invoke chaos theory. Because it's like the earth or the future is just so finely balanced. And that's the old idea of like the old butterfly sort of flapping its wings in Beijing causes a storm somewhere else. The future is so finely balanced all the time. This is basic science. There's just a slight nudge this way, a slight nudge that way, and it changes the whole future. That's why you can't say it's being determined. No way can we know what's going to happen. Yeah. Oh, you face the consequences.
Whether or not, choice happens or
we can face the physical consequences, but we don't need to face the guilt. Yeah, there's always consequences. But sometimes the understanding of the consequences is what conditions the world as well.
And we can't avoid it by saying,
you can avoid a lot of the consequences are the mental consequences. The sense of guilt or grief or pride. And those are the main consequences. Because when people do some things and it doesn't turn out right, it's amazing just how many people get stuck in guilt. Think, oh, I shouldn't have done that. Why did I do that? And sometimes it's, maybe you're like somebody called up last week and their child was getting involved in drugs. And they were feeling guilty as if it was their fault. It's amazing just how Western people get so guilty and think that they're responsible for even some of the decisions of their child. That's a consequence, but sometimes when you look back, because you've done anything else.
No, but it's still a consequence.
The consequence, but you don't need to feel guilty about it or feel bad about it.
But I think the Western has to walk that really fine line of not feeling guilty. I think it's just self-blame and it's a pretty useless emotion. But I think that's where Westerns too very often. I don't know about other cultures.
Mm. Yeah, we can face the consequences. We always have to face the consequences of our actions. But we don't have to give this mental negativity towards it. And most of the consequences are the mental consequences. The physical ones we can always deal with. The worst part of any experience is the mental part of it. And it's amazing, just whatever choice you make. This is one of the things which I've got to become very aware of. Whatever choice you make, there's not really such a thing as a good choice and a bad choice. It's just different. And whatever door you go through, you can always make something good out of it. So, if there is, the unpleasant consequence of your actions, you can use the unpleasantness to grow in wisdom and compassion. So it's all really useful. So I can't see anything in this world which can't be used to create greater wisdom and greater compassion. And even the things which some people say are negative, you can still make use of it. I don't know how many people I've counselled who have got cancer who keep on saying that's the best thing which ever happened to them. And this is, I'm just reporting what they say. But they've had an experience which has been very painful, unpleasant. They learned so much out of it. And afterwards they say, I wouldn't have given that up for the world. At the time they didn't like it, but afterwards they say, wow, they learned and grew so much from that experience. And that's an example of sometimes the unpleasant experiences of life. Sometimes we can make use of those things. It's fertilizer for our wisdom and compassion.
What was it?
That's correct. That's correct. Because sometimes it's so easy to look at the past and think you could have done better, or it could have worked out this way, it could have worked out that way. But you can't change that past. And you don't really know what might have happened if you did a different way. Which is why we always tend to want to let go of the past. And even what we remember of the past is not accurate. We always think we know what happened, but you ask two people what happened, they've got different ideas of what happened. Different experiences. So it's best to let go of the past. And that's a wonderful thing, to know you can let go of the past. You can be free. Which is why I call like the past, it's like a prison cell, which with the doors open, we can walk out any time we want. If we really want to. A lot of times we don't want to. Anyway, let's get to the next question. Is jhana very necessary for Magapala? Yes, some teachers teach only the second foundation of mindfulness, feelings. It's okay to notice feelings, but if you notice what the Satipatthana actually says, that as a prerequisite to doing any of the four Satipatthanas, they say vinaye loke abhijjato manasa, which I mentioned yesterday is having abandoned what's usually translated grief and covetousness for the world. What the really means is having abandoned the first two hindrances, and the commentary says, which means the other five hindrances as well. So the prerequisite before doing the Satipatthana is having abandoned the hindrances. And the way you abandon the hindrances is through doing the jhanas. That's the Nalakapana Sutta. So it's okay to do the Satipatthana, but to really get the Satipatthana which will make you enlightened, you have to have abandoned the hindrances first of all. And that's the job of jhana. And some teachers only teach the third foundation of mindfulness, thoughts. Is it possible for one to reach final liberation just practicing one foundation of mindfulness? Isn't the Eightfold Path the only way to liberation? Yes, you got the answer right in the very end. The Buddha actually said the only way to liberation is the Eightfold Path. Eso wa mago nati anyo dasanasa visuddhiya. And that's in the Magga. Magawaka of the Dhammapada, which meant this is the only way, there is no other, for the purification of insight, and that's the Eightfold Path. So unfortunately you can't have a Sevenfold Path or a Sixfold Path or five or four or three or two. You have to have all the eight factors, which means you have to keep your precepts, right speech and right action, right livelihood. So you can't just do the third factor of the Satipatthana and not keep your precepts. And also you need the last factor, Samma Samadhi. The eighth factor of the Eightfold Path is always, without any exception throughout the whole of the Sutta Pitaka, defined as jhanas. 1, 2, 3, 4 jhanas. That's why the jhanas are necessary. That's why we teach jhanas. And anyone who's actually experienced the jhana will know why it's necessary. Can you explain what animitta is? Animitta is no nimitta. That's what it means. I don't know what they really mean by this question. So whoever asks this question, they need to actually answer it, ask it more full, because I don't really understand what you're really asking. Or why you're asking. Animitta means no nimitta. Wow, another friend. Thank you for the wonderful Dhamma talk this morning. That's another very good question. Oh, I got a picture of Ajahn Chah. I found this in one of his books and thought you might like it. That's Ajahn Chah. Is that really Ajahn Chah? No, it's just a picture of Ajahn Chah. That's not Ajahn Chah. So remember, who is the real Ajahn Chah? So where can you find the best picture of Ajahn Chah? Inside your meditation. In your heart. Ajahn Chah, the still wise being in your heart. That's why sometimes the Mahayana states about the Buddha nature. So where can you find the Buddha nature? The Buddha nature is right inside you in this very moment. The awakening nature, the enlightenment, the wisdom. So if you really want to see the Buddha, you don't need to go to the four holy places in India. They're nice to go to. But if you really want to see the Buddha, and this is actually from the Mahahatipadopama Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya. If you really want to see the footprints of the Buddha, the sutta says there are four footprints of the Buddha. You know what those four footprints are? First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. That's the footprints of the Buddha. And quite literally, if you experience any of those states of mind, you experience exactly what the Buddha was in his meditation. You've got the exact same mind, the exact same experience. So if you really want to see the Buddha, experience the Buddha, and you go deep inside the mind and experience the jhana, and that's like being a Buddha. That's why it's powerful and fantastic. So, if you really want to go on pilgrimage and find out where the Buddha hung out and the places where he spent so much of his life, you don't need to get a visa. You don't need to get an expensive air ticket. All you need to do is to come for a 9-day retreat to the Redemptorist Monastery and go for a tour of the holy places inside your own body and mind. And there you will see where the Buddha hung out. Deep in the stillness, in the center of this. So that's actually how you can get into deep meditation and taste what the Buddha tasted. In the deep meditations, there's no body left. So any sort of bodies of being Indian or being Chinese or being Australian or whatever just completely disappears. All you've got left is the mind. And all of the defilements of the mind which separate us have all disappeared. All you've got is the unity of the mind. The same experience as experienced by the Buddha under the Bodhi tree. So getting an idea of what it felt like to be a Buddha. Da da da. Okay. So there we go, some questions this evening, some a couple of jokes. I went through the questions quite quickly because there was a lot here, but those of you who are still worried about will and non-self, don't worry about that, because later on I'll give a much deeper talk about the will and non-self and how it all comes together and how amazing it is to know that there's no one in there. So, until that time, when you think there is somebody in there, you better sort of work very hard by doing nothing and have a nice evening. The evening at night is still young, so those of you who've got lots of energy, carry on meditating. Those of you who get tired, please don't feel guilty going to bed early because you had no choice. Okay, so good night everybody. See you tomorrow morning.